You know, what we're experiencing right now didn't just drop out of the sky. You know, there's a legacy there, there's a history there, there's past experiences that have brought us here today. And I think it's important for leaders and stakeholders and people on boards, if they're really interested in learning about these inequalities, that they have to look at the history of how we got here.
Hi, Erin.
Hi, Ashley. What are you up to?
Oh, you know, the usual. I've fallen once again into a black hole of research on the internet about history, policy, sociology, and economics. The gravitational pull is too strong, and I'm legitimately concerned I've gone too deep.
So basically another Thursday.
Yep.
What are you working on today?
I was interested in learning a bit more about how Jim Crow laws may have impacted communities of color in the U.S. from coast to coast. These laws limited who you were allowed to marry, your access to education, and even the kinds of jobs and economic opportunities you could tap into.
Ah, yes. I remember learning about and discussing those laws in school. The history and the scope are stunning.
And even more so when you consider that these sorts of laws were in place well into the 1960s.
That kind of discrimination that lasts for hundreds of years and crosses every major area of society, from education and hiring to healthcare and housing, doesn't change when laws do. It's not like flipping a switch. It becomes ingrained in the culture. It also feeds the unconscious bias we discussed in episode 2, and it's a foundational element of many of the things we'll explore across this entire series.
Exactly. We know that making sense of the past is also key to understanding the future, including topics we'll get into later in the series like artificial intelligence, the future of work, and how data is shaping the business landscape. And that foundation is critical context if we want to really understand the challenges with the talent pipeline, a topic we'll delve into next episode.
Luckily, we have some really smart folks teed up who can help shed light on all of this, including what it means for the economy and the way we do business. I'm Erin Essenmacher.
And I'm Ashley Marchand Orme.
And this is Future Fluency, the podcast where we discuss the changing face of America through the lens of innovation, culture, and their impacts on business.
Today, we're talking about institutional discrimination, what it looks like historically, how that history shapes the present, and what it means for business.
Ashley, I learned a lot about that history and its personal impact from your great conversation with Catrice Jackson.
Yes, Catrice is an author and mental health counselor who's developed practical workshops on how to create constructive interracial interactions. She had great insight into how institutional discrimination provides a blueprint for the inequality we see today.
I host workshops all over the country, and I take those workshops from city to city, and it really is a brave space where women from all backgrounds can come into those spaces and really have a hard, straight up, no chaser, as I call it, conversation about race and racism. And, you know, it's difficult sometimes, but I think that it's necessary. I think that we need to continue to have these conversations. You know, what we're experiencing right now didn't just drop out of the sky. You know, there's a legacy there, there's a history there, there's past experiences that have brought us here today. There's a 300-year delay that for 300 years due to chattel slavery and Jim Crow and slave codes and all the things that are very real, history is there, you can find that, that essentially put Black people 300 years behind the curve. And so when we look at where we are today, we have to take that into consideration that, you know, Black folks weren't able to, you know, have land, weren't able to grow crops. One of the examples that I often use is that technically I am the first, quote unquote, free generation in my family. What I mean by that is that my mother grew up in the Jim Crow era. So she was limited in a lot of ways. There were things that she couldn't have, she couldn't do, places she couldn't go. My grandmother talked about how she remembers holding her mother's hand, who was a slave at the time. And so just three generations back, I can still touch the impact of chattel slavery. It was legal to say, no, you cannot build generational wealth. No, you cannot go get an education so that you can educate the next generation. That, to me, paints a very clear picture on what systemic racism has done to Black and brown folks in this country, that people of my age, you know, 40-ish or so, we are the first free generation for a lot of Black families. And so we're just now able to get the education that we need to get the jobs. We're just now able to start building that generational wealth that we can pass on to our children.
Erin, what Catrice is saying there about the Black community's barriers to building generational wealth relates back to the business environment in a few ways. Think about the impact of stifling wealth creation for an entire people group. Wealth creation gives you access to resources like better education, and better education can help sharpen your skills so you can stand out in a pool of job applicants, which then impacts your ability to get the next job and the next. This all gets to the talent pipeline, which, as I mentioned, we'll discuss in more detail next episode.
Yes, and wealth creation also impacts the ability to purchase housing and property that can increase in value significantly over time, thereby creating the kind of income that can also serve as a financial cushion to weather difficulties like economic downturns, and creates wealth you can pass down to your kids. And while education and housing are just two facets of the discussion on wealth and access to resources, they're really important because they are foundational tools for success in this country.
Right. I spoke recently with Richard Rothstein, a historian and a distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute. Richard wrote a book called The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. Richard is also a senior fellow at the UC Berkeley School of Law's Haas Institute. He's done quite a bit of research on how governmental policies did and still do impact the Black community. Here's Richard in his own words describing his book.
The book demolishes the notion of de facto segregation. What the book shows is that the primary reason that we have segregated neighborhoods everywhere in this country is because very powerful federal, state, and local government policies that were explicitly designed on a racial basis to keep Blacks and whites separate in where they live. It goes through policy after policy after policy that the federal, state, and local governments followed to ensure that African Americans and whites could not live near one another in any metropolitan area of this country.
That is really disturbing. So what Richard is saying there is that much of the segregation we saw in the last century and that lingers still today is by design, and our laws were the blueprint.
Exactly. We're going to spend the bulk of our time today hearing from Richard. His work lays out in clear terms how racism, when reinforced by rules, regulations, and laws, literally becomes institutionalized. Hence the term institutional racism.
We're going to dive in depth into the specifics of housing policy and how it's at the root of everything from income inequality to the unconscious bias that drives our attitudes around race. The way that Richard came to this work is, in and of itself, a powerful example of the ripple effects of housing policy.
Yes, he started with a focus on education, and that led him to housing. His experience shows how policies in one area, like real estate, can impact healthcare and education, and then make major ripples across society and the economy.
I had been the education columnist of the New York Times for a while. I wrote on education policy for the Economic Policy Institute. I came to understand that the most powerful reason that we have an achievement gap between African-American and white children was not because they weren't motivated. It wasn't because schools weren't trying hard enough or the kids weren't tested often enough or because the schools weren't held accountable. The primary reason was that the most disadvantaged children in this country were being concentrated in single schools, where their social and economic problems overwhelmed the ability of schools to address them, where those problems directly caused lower achievement. For example, I wrote a column I remember once about asthma. Well, African-American children in urban neighborhoods have asthma at four times the rate of white middle-class children. If they have asthma, they're likely to be wheezing at night. They may come to school drowsy and sleepless. And I tried to explain if you had two groups of children who were equal in every respect, except one group was coming to school sleepier than the other, that group was going to have lower average achievement no matter how accountable the schools were and how often the children were tested. And I showed that when you take children with those problems, whether it's asthma or lead poisoning or homelessness or stress from parental economic insecurity or poorly educated parents, the notion that we can address the achievement gap without dealing with those problems was false. And so I became concerned with our schools being segregated. And the reality is that today in the United States, schools are more segregated than they have been at any time since the Brown v. Board of Education decision began to be implemented. More segregated today. And the reason they're more segregated is the neighborhoods in which they're located are segregated.
That connection that Richard is making between housing, education, and the opportunity for achievement is significant.
And on top of some of the housing policies that have led to segregated communities and schools, there have also been studies conducted on discrepancies in how children are treated in schools. The U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights published a study in 2014 on discipline in public schools. The study found that while Black children make up just 18% of the preschool population, they also make up almost half of preschool suspensions. Looking at all groups of school-aged children, the study found that schools are three times more likely to suspend Black students than white students for similar offenses.
And we know from our conversations around bias that if you have a perception that a certain group of kids is less motivated, then you may look at an individual child from that group and see a, quote, behavior problem even before the kid opens their mouth. It reminds me of what Richard said, that folks make assumptions that certain kids don't do as well in a test because they are less motivated, when the root causes are actually different and deeper. Oftentimes, they have nothing to do with an individual child and everything to do with disparities driven by economics and rooted in things like discriminatory housing policy. This goes back to what we were discussing earlier about how even if policies change, discrimination can linger.
Right. Richard and I dug a bit deeper there. And he shared an example of how housing policy directly worked to feed those negative stereotypes.
After World War II, most working class families were living in urban areas at the time. We were in a suburban nation at the time. The federal government began a policy to suburbanize the entire white population into single family homes in all white suburbs. Levittown is probably the most famous of them, 17,000 homes east of New York City. Another one is little boxes on a hillside made of ticky-tacky, and they all look the same, a song that was written by Malvina Reynolds about a suburb almost as large as Levittown, south of San Francisco. A builder like Levitt, or the builder of those little boxes south of San Francisco, his name was Henry Dolger. Those builders could never have assembled the capital to build subdivisions that large. No bank would be crazy enough to lend them money to do so because we weren't a suburban nation. Nobody even thought that people might want to live out in the suburbs in single-family homes. The only way that Levittown could be built and the only way that Westlake could be built was when the builders, Levitt and Dolger, went to the Federal Housing Administration, submitting their plans for the developments that included the layout of the subdivision, the materials they would use, and a commitment never to sell a home to an African American. The Federal Housing Administration even required them to place a clause in the deed of every home prohibiting resale to African Americans or rental to African Americans. Once those commitments had been made, the Federal Housing Administration or the Veterans Administration guaranteed their bank loans so that they could proceed with the developments. Whites were moved out of cities. They could pay less. White families, returning war veterans, could pay less with an VA or an FHA mortgage in Levittown or one of these other suburbs, pay less monthly, than they had been paying for rent in public housing in the central city. And so it was an enormous incentive for them to move. On this basis, the entire country was suburbanized.
Wow, that is a lot to take in.
Right?
Essentially, the suburbs as we know them today started specifically as a way to separate white and Black families.
Richard explained how this segregation fed income inequality and, in part, prevented the Black community from owning property and building wealth, like Catrice talked about at the beginning of the show.
The federal government locked African Americans into overcrowded neighborhoods in urban areas, denied them, for example, FHA mortgages even in their own neighborhoods. That's where the term red line comes from. The federal government drew maps of urban areas, colored the areas red where African Americans were living, and didn't issue mortgages to families who lived in those red zones. Those neighborhoods became poorer and poorer. Soon, in the 1950s, industry left those very neighborhoods, moved to the suburbs and to rural areas because it no longer needed to be located near deep water ports or near railroad terminals to get parts and ship final products. That further made the African Americans living in these neighborhoods poorer and poorer because they no longer had access to jobs. In order to afford housing, they frequently subdivided their homes, overcrowded them, boarded up relatives with them. Life moved out of homes into the streets. Anytime we have a social situation, a structure that was created by various social forces, they create stereotypes. And people who are not sophisticated about understanding how those structures were created can have misunderstandings of the characteristics of the people who either suffer or benefit from those stereotypes. Well, white families looked at these neighborhoods, slums, and they concluded that African Americans were slum dwellers, and that if African Americans moved into their neighborhoods would become slums as well. They didn't understand that the slum conditions, the overcrowded conditions, the poverty, was a creation of government policy. And so the stereotypes were created and reinforced prejudices that already existed, making our problems much worse.
Based on Richard's research, you can draw a straight line from government-sanctioned housing policy to the lingering prejudice we see today.
And we know from our previous conversations that bias comes from perceptions we have, but oftentimes are not conscious of or don't question.
Richard's insights help us connect the dots between our policies and our bias.
Speaking of connecting the dots, Richard and I also talked about this wealth gap, not just what it means when we think about participation in the U.S. economy, but how it provides fuel for the bias that leads to the racial and political polarization that we see infecting society.
The houses were relatively inexpensive. They cost $8,000 or $9,000 a piece. Today, those homes sell for not $100,000, but $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, some places more. The white families who were subsidized by the federal government in this way to move out of cities and into all-white suburbs gained over the next few generations wealth from the appreciation and the value of their homes, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 in wealth. They used it to send their children to college. They used it to finance emergencies, whether it was temporary unemployment or maybe a medical emergency. They used to subsidize their own retirements, and they used it to bequeath wealth to their own children. As a result, we have an enormous wealth gap in this country today by race. African-American incomes today are about 60% of white incomes. You'd think that with a 60% income ratio, you'd have roughly a 60% wealth ratio. But in fact, African-American wealth is only on average about 10% of white wealth. And that enormous disparity between a 60% income ratio and a 10% wealth ratio is entirely attributable to unconstitutional federal housing policy that was practiced in the mid-20th century and that we've never remedied. The wealth gap is an important, if not the most important, determinant of inequality between the races today. It also determines, as I suggested earlier, the achievement gap in schools when we concentrate the most disadvantaged children in single neighborhoods. It determines, in large part, the health disparities. African Americans have shorter life expectancies, greater rates of heart disease because so many of them live in less healthy neighborhoods. It's responsible, in large part, for the outrageous criminal justice system that incarcerates so many young African American men who would not be incarcerated if they weren't being concentrated in single neighborhoods without opportunity, without access to jobs in the formal economy. And I think that the segregation that we created also determines, in good part, the very dangerous political polarization in this country today that's a threat to our democracy. If so many African Americans and whites live so far from each other and continue to live so far from each other, it's inconceivable that they will develop the kind of empathy for each other, the kind of understanding of each other's life experiences that's essential for the formation of a common national identity.
So Richard is saying that if we continue to live apart from each other, we can't form the kinds of relationships and interactions that foster understanding and empathy, which in turn makes it easier to see people who we might actually have a lot in common with as other.
Yes, and that lack of understanding is not just a threat to our democracy.
No small thing.
Right. It also lays the groundwork for other things we'll be talking about across this series, like why it's so difficult to talk about race at work, or how blind spots around diversity inhibit innovation.
I want to go back to that tie-in between education and housing, especially since we know that access to education has such a profound impact on a person's future employment prospects.
Richard's research here is illuminating.
In 2007, I read a Supreme Court decision that evaluated a very token desegregation plan that the school districts of Louisville, Kentucky, and Seattle, Washington had. They said it was unconstitutional. They said it was impermissible for the school districts to try to explicitly redress racial segregation. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the opinion. He said that the schools in Louisville and Seattle are segregated because the neighborhoods in which they located are segregated. Well, he was right about that. That is why the schools in Louisville and Seattle are segregated. But he said the schools in Louisville and Seattle are segregated because the neighborhoods in which they located are segregated. And those neighborhoods, he said, are segregated de facto without government responsibility. And therefore, it's all a private action, a private result. Government has nothing to do with it, and government has no responsibility or authority to remedy it.
So basically, the Supreme Court is making decisions based on the idea that segregation was self-imposed, and therefore it shouldn't be the government's responsibility to remedy it, except we know from redline laws that the government was the original architect of that segregation.
Totally. And Richard shared a story involving one of the school districts in the court case, which took place just 50 years earlier. And it shows in heartbreaking detail how the law functioned to reinforce whites-only neighborhoods.
There was a suburb called Shively where there was a white homeowner living in a single-family home. And he had an African-American friend who was living in the center city of Louisville. The African-American friend was a decorated Navy veteran. He was had a wife and child, a decent income, good job, wanted to move his family to a single-family home, but nobody would sell him one. So the white homeowner in this suburb of Shively bought a second home in the suburb and resold it to his African-American friend. When the African-American friend moved in, an angry mob of whites surrounded the home, protected by the police. The whites threw rocks through the windows. The police somehow couldn't identify a perpetrator. They dynamited and firebombed the home, and the police somehow still couldn't identify who was responsible. Nobody was arrested, except at the end of the riot, the white homeowner was arrested, tried, convicted, and jailed with a 15-year jail sentence for sedition for having sold a home to an African-American in a white neighborhood. And I read this decision, remembered this decision, having read the Supreme Court decision in 2007. And I said to myself, this doesn't sound to me much like de facto segregation if the criminal justice system is being used to enforce racial boundaries in this way. I began to investigate it further, and one of the policies I discovered was that there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases in the mid-20th century where police-protected mob violence drove African-Americans out of homes they had legitimately purchased in white neighborhoods. Every one of these, where it was police-protected, was a violation of the 14th Amendment. That has never been remedied.
Aaron, by this point in the interview, I had what I can only describe as this unspoken desperation to hear how we can solve for some of these issues.
I can understand why you'd feel like that. One way is by having hard conversations like this one, where we work to understand our history as context for how to do better, and understanding that if racism is rooted in structure, we need to focus on structural change. If your house is not built on a solid foundation and it starts to collapse, you don't swap out the drapes. You get down on the foundation and figure out how to make it stronger.
Richard had some powerful ideas about how to address those foundational causes of institutional racism. And one big surprise, it involves rethinking some of the policies we've pointed to for decades as the solution.
We have a number of policies today for low-income families that helps to support their housing. They typically reinforce segregation. The biggest one that we have for low-income families is something called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit. It's a tax credit issued by the U.S. Treasury Department to states for distribution to developers of low-income housing. Developers build most of their low-income housing in already low-income neighborhoods, reinforcing their segregation. They do it because land is cheaper there. They do it because there's no community opposition to building housing that's affordable in already low-income neighborhoods. They do it because it's easy to rent. You can put a sign in the window and lots of low-income people will walk by seeing a for rent sign. We could very easily modify that policy to require a share, a larger share, of those developments to be placed in high opportunity communities where families had access to jobs and opportunity and healthy air and supermarkets that sold fresh food and schools that had higher achievement. So that would be a policy that would be easy to remedy. The same thing is true of another policy that maybe your listeners are more familiar with, and that's the Section 8 voucher program. That's a subsidy to families, low-income families, so that they can afford to rent apartments that are otherwise unaffordable to them at median rents in their community. But those vouchers also reinforce segregation because in almost everywhere in the country, there are a few exceptions, but almost everywhere in the country, landlords and middle-class communities refuse to accept Section 8 vouchers. This is not considered a violation of the Fair Housing Act. It's the only kind of discrimination that's permitted under the Fair Housing Act. You can't discriminate on the basis of religion or race explicitly, or disability or family size, but you can't discriminate against somebody who has a Section 8 voucher, and these people are disproportionately minority. So it's a form of discrimination that reinforces segregation.
Aaron, given the focus of our series, I asked specifically if there were steps board members and other business leaders could take to address some of the issues Richard discussed.
Business leaders are citizens. They mold public opinion in their community. They're influential. They live in communities, so they can take leadership in creating the kind of political pressure that's needed for the policies to redress segregation. I think the main thing that's true of all of us, business leaders or otherwise, is that we have an obligation as American citizens under the Constitution to redress this civil rights violation.
I love a good call to action, and Richard has made a compelling case for why it takes all of us, especially those who have the social and political capital, to understand and address the consequences of historically discriminatory policies. It reminds me of what Howard Ross said about addressing unconscious bias. Don't waste time feeling guilty that you have it. Just work to understand and fix it.
And one way that business leaders can be part of that fix is by understanding this context as they're creating hiring and personnel policies.
And that's perfect to set the stage for what we'll be talking about next episode, the talent pipeline.
Boards talk about the competition they know. It's the competition you don't know.
The pipeline's not very encouraging. And so even though corporations are talking about diversity and inclusion, I think that the better conversation is diverse inclusion disaggregated. You have to talk about each affected group and what kind of progress each group's making.
Oh, that's going to be a good conversation.
I think so.
For NACD and Future Fluency, I'm Ashley Marchand-Orme.
And I'm Erin Essenmacher. Thanks for listening.
For guest bios, more resources, and a link to this episode's transcript, check out the show notes or the episode page at nacdonline.org/podcast.
Future Fluency is produced and edited by Bruno Falcon, with production support from Carrie Sheehan. Special thanks to Jeanette Woods. Future Fluency is a production of the National Association of Corporate Directors. For more information on NACD or to become a member, visit nacdonline.org.